Chapter 16. It was truly a cell now. The door remained locked, even when Nicholas knocked on it. Meals, interviews, and his lawyer, that was all it opened for, and the trip to the magistrate's court. The police had taken him there on Friday morning, 24 hours after Eleanor Mandell had tossed about on the bed in his room at the Abbey, opening her eyes to reveal abject revulsion, and rolling over to throw up on the glossy polythene sheet covering the carpet. It was the look she had given him which wounded him most, the absolute horror, as if his very presence could contaminate her soul. And she'd been so nice to him before, so friendly, not seeming to notice his embarrassment at the shock her appearance had triggered. Girls don't normally treat him like that. He was either non-existent or an object of pity, sometimes of scorn. He was secretly a little bit in love with Eleanor. She seemed so forthright, able to cope with life. She was also staggeringly pretty, even though thinking that was disloyal to Isabel. The words had come stammering out of her mouth as she gagged, Greg hugging her shoulders, protective and concerned. "He did it! Jesus! He didn't even blink!" She sucked down some air, wiping a sticky thread of vomit from her lips. "What are you?" That was when her mad eyes found him, their stare an almost tangible force, tightening round his throat. Something shivered inside him then, enervating his legs. The cold, terrible certainty that she must mean him. She was accusing him. Who? It was spoken by half the people in the room. He may even have joined in. He couldn't remember. But she said nothing, just glared, her ragged breathing the only sound. Then Greg's stare was added to hers, calm and hateful, and Nicholas felt his face reddening even as the clamour of bewilderment inside his skull made him blurt, "What? What? What have I done?" "He did it," Greg told the detectives. His voice had gone husky, saddened more than anything. Langley had looked at Nicholas, then Greg, then back again. "Him?" he asked, incredulously. "Bezick?"
"For Christ's sake, put some handcuffs on him," Eleanor rasped. "If only you'd seen what he did."
Greg's arm tightened round her. She had started to tremble.
"But you interviewed him," Bernard Langley said. "You cleared him."
"I told you when we started. I'd never seen that kind of mind before. Didn't know what to look for. Well, now I do. He's completely cracked. Won't even admit it to himself. Jesus, he was fucking inhuman back there."
"No,"
Nicholas said, but nobody appeared to have heard him.
"No, I didn't. I didn't do that."
"Are you sure?"
Langley asked Greg, reluctantly.
"Yeah, it was him."
"No,"
Nicholas said.
"No."
Amanda Patterson and John Nevin had somehow moved to stand on either side of his chair. He glanced up at them, face pleading.
"I didn't."
"Is there any proof? Solid proof, I mean," Langley asked. "Can we test the claws he was wearing?"
"I can do you one better than that," Greg said. "I can show you where he left the knife."
"I didn't do it! Why wouldn't anyone listen?"
"It's downstairs, in the kitchen," Greg said.
"We'll check the kitchen," Amanda retorted indignantly.
"Not all of it."
"You too,"
Langley signalled his colleagues. "Bring him with us and keep an eye on him. I don't want any sudden sprints across the park."
"I'll stay up here,"
Eleanor said shakily.
"Me too,"
Gabriel said.
"Okay,"
Greg said. He patted Eleanor's shoulder.
"I'll be back straight away."
She nodded weakly, hunching in on herself as though she was freezing. Nicholas felt John Nevin's hand on his forearm. He didn't protest. His strangely leaden limbs needed all the help they could get to rise out of the chair. Gabriel had gone to sit beside Eleanor, the two of them with their heads together, murmuring quietly. In the kitchen, Greg walked straight over to the iron range.
"It's in here."
He pointed to the copper bedwarmer hanging on the wall.
"He hid it when he was burning the apron."
"Don't touch it,"
Denzel said. He and Nicolette cleared the kitchen table, covering it with a broad sheet of polythene. They put on thin yellow gloves and gingerly took the bedwarmer off its hook. The three detectives crowded round as Denzel opened it. Nicholas couldn't see. Langley turned round, his face struggling against an expression of loathing.
"Nicholas Bezick, I am arresting you on suspicion of the murder of one Edward Kitchener."
"No!"
There was a long knife in the bedwarmer, its blade snapped off at the base so that it could be wedged into the tarnished copper basin. The handle was rolling loose in the bottom. Both were stained black from dried blood.
"You do not have to say anything at this time, but anything you do say will be taken down and may be used as evidence against you in a court of law."
His hands were jerked behind him, rings of cold metal constricting his wrists, the snick of the locks.
"I didn't do it."
They were deaf, immune to any words he said. They also detested him. He had never known that before. People so rarely paid him any attention at all. In the first few days after the murder, the Oakham police had treated him with a slightly puzzled indulgence, as if he was some kind of foreign animal that they didn't know how to feed properly. But after Nevin brought him back from the Abbey, it had been different. The word had gone out in advance. Off-duty officers had stood in doorways as he was marched through the station corridors to his cell. He'd cringed from the way they regarded him, the naked revulsion, expecting to be set upon and beaten. There had been no violence. The cuffs had been tight, though, his hands swelling and swelling until he thought they would burst. They had left them on for ages, long after his fingers had gone numb, dragging out the booking procedure. He had caught one glimpse of Isabel, just as he was being put into the cell. Nevin was finally taking off his cuffs in the corridor outside when she emerged from the cell she'd been sleeping in. He cried out her name, and she turned. That was when he saw her face was like all the others.
"I didn't do it!"
Her head tipped to one side, faintly nonplussed, at one remove from the world, like the times he'd seen her performing a difficult equation. There was virtually no sign of recognition.
"Please, Isabel, I didn't!"
Her bottom lip turned down, as if it was all of no consequence. Trivia. She was still utterly beautiful. A shove between his shoulder blades sent him stumbling into the cell as blood and feeling shot violently back into his hands. The door slammed shut, lock whirring. He had thought the night was bad, alone with near-suicidal confusion, the memories of the allegations. Eleanor's desolated face, the knife with its awful scale of black flakes. Nobody would talk to him. The sergeant who brought his evening meal simply slammed the moulded tray down on the table, mute. Somehow, somewhere, there had been a terrible mistake. He had waited and waited for them to find out where they had gone wrong, to come back and set him free. He didn't want an apology, he just wanted to be allowed to go. Gnats and small ochre moths emerged from the dead conditioning grill, fluttering silently round the bioloom panel. The light stayed on all night. Nicholas huddled into a corner of the cell below the high window, drawing his knees up against his chest, a blanket round his shoulders, waiting, waiting. Friday morning was worse, thrusting him from the extreme of his solitude into the bedlam of the media madhouse. Oakham Magistrates Court sat in the castle hall. It was a short drive around the park from the police station. Nicholas spent the whole time in the car with a blanket over his head. He felt the car judder to a halt. The door was opened. Shouts were flung at him.
"Did you do it? What was your motive, Nick? Were you on drugs?"
He tried to screw himself into the car seat. A hand like steel clamped onto his arm, pulling him out.
"Come on, son, this way. Keep looking at your feet. There's no step."
The questions merged into a single protracted yowl. He could see tarmac below his trainers, then pale yellow stone. The light changed. He was inside. The blanket was pulled off. He was in a short passage with whitewashed walls, narrow and cramped. Lisa Collier was standing in front of him, the two of them at the centre of a jostling circle of police.
"I didn't do it," he told the lawyer frantically. "Please, Mrs. Collier, you have to believe me."
She ran a hand back through her hair, giving him a flustered glance.
"Nicholas, we'll get all that sorted out later. Do you know why you're here?"
"Where are we?"
she groaned, shooting Langley an evil stare.
"Christ. All right, now, this is the magistrate's court, Nicholas. They've convened a special sitting. The police want you remanded in their custody for 72 hours so they can question you. You haven't officially been charged with anything yet, all right? There is no basis for me opposing the application. Do you understand?"
"I didn't do it."
"Nicholas, pay attention. We're not entering pleas today. They'll just remand you in custody and take you back to the station. There will be a lawyer present at every interview. Now, do you want me to continue as your lawyer?"
"Yes. Yes, please."
"All right. Now, look, we're going right in. You won't have to say anything, just confirm your name when the clerk of the court asks. Got that?"
"Yes, my name."
"Fine. Now look, there's no way I could have the press excluded, so it's a bit of a circus in there. But they're not allowed to take pictures in an English court, thank God. Do your best just to ignore them."
She looked him up and down, then rounded on Langley.
"There's no bloody excuse for him turning up in this state. It amounts to intimidation in my book."
Langley tweaked his tie. He was wearing a neat grey suit.
"Sorry, we were a bit rushed for time back there. Won't happen again."
"You're damn right it won't," she said in disgust.
The ancient hall was so bizarre that Nicholas was convinced he'd fallen into some Alice in Wonderland nightmare. There were six thick stone pillars, supporting a high vaulted ceiling. Each whitewashed wall was covered in horseshoes of all sizes, ranging from the genuine article up to elaborate gilded arches a meter and a half high. Most of them had crowns on top. All were inscribed with the names of the nobles, dignitaries and royalty who had presented them to the county. The court itself only took up the front half of the hall, an enclosure of tacky wooden pew benches, painted a light grey, a defendant's box at the back. Behind that was an open space about 20 meters square. When he walked out of a small door in the front wall, handcuffed John Nevin, he nearly faltered. There were about 100 reporters packed onto the rear floor space. Every one of them was staring at him. He was led to the box facing the magistrate's bench, ever conscious of those greedy eyes boring into the back of his neck. The proceedings were short, formularized. He remembered to acknowledge the clerk. Then all he had to do was listen to the police lawyer read his request from a cyberfax. Flowery legal language, grotesquely arcane. Why did the world stick to these rituals? His lawyer was on her feet, saying something. Nicholas could hear the shuffling feet behind him, smothered coughs, gentle, persistent clicking of fingers on cyberfax keys. He could feel the curiosity they radiated, a silent demand to know, as though they had more right than the police and the lawyers.
"Granted," said the chief magistrate,
a middle-aged woman from the same stout mould as Lisa Collier. The officials on the pew benches were standing up, talking together in low tones. "Come on," Nevin said. Nicholas got to his feet and halted. The reporters held still, collectively silent, expectant. Nevin was tugging insistently at his arm, equally uncomfortable at being in the limelight.
"I didn't do it,"
Nicholas said. They would listen, at least. Nobody else did.
"I didn't."
There was no answer. He was frog-marched out by Nevin and two uniformed constables. The ignominious blanket, the car ride. He could hear rain pounding on the streets. The cell. Confinement. Keeping the monster behind bars. Protecting the public from his savagery. Old men could sleep safer in their beds now. This time the walls were closer together, the ceiling lower. At night they closed around his body, embedding him in cold, black marble. Rosette was a natural channel star, the graceful curves of her face bewitching the camera, promoting her regality, betraying no sign of her contumacy. She was standing on the pavement outside Oakham Police Station, beside a long, modern, navy-blue Aston Martin, driven by a chauffeur. The front passenger door was open, and she held herself poised to enter, doing the reporters a big favour by indulging them. The sunlight caught her fair hair to perfection as it fell on the shoulders of her leaf-green jacket.
"The baby is due in 7 months," she said. "I expect to have it in a London clinic. But it will definitely be born in England. Edward would have wanted that. He was a great nationalist."
The baby was news to Nicholas. He accepted the fact numbly. There ought to have been some tiny part of him which was glad, but he couldn't find it. Was that the kind of cyborg mind which enabled people to butcher their murder victims? But if he was so insensitive, why had he fallen in love with Isabel? It was most puzzling, his mind.
"How long had you and Kitchener been having an affair?" a reporter asked.
"I think I fell in love with Edward when I was 8 years old. I remember seeing him on a Channel Science cast. He was so impassioned about his subject, and yet he always allowed his sense of humour to shine through. He was so much more alive than any other person. It was after that I concentrated on science subjects at school. He remained in my thoughts, an unsung mentor, an inspiration. Being invited to study at Laund Abbey was a lifetime ambition."
"He was a lot older than you. Did that pose any difficulty, some tension?"
"His mind was fresher than anybody's on this planet."
"Do you know what he was working on when he was killed?"
"A star drive, darling. A faster-than-light star drive. Edward was going to give us the galaxy. He believed in human destiny, you see. It was to be his gift for all the peoples of the world. So none of us would ever be restricted and oppressed again. We could spread our wings and truly blossom amid the splendour of the night."
"It wasn't a star drive," Nicholas said to the cell's flat screen. Typical Rosette to go for theatrical effect.
"A working star drive?"
Even the reporter was sceptical.
"Oh, yes. He was studying the loopholes allowed for in general relativity. With his genius and Event Horizon's money, I genuinely believe a starship could have been built. Now, though, who knows?"
Her face was haunted by poignancy.
I have a dream that one day our child would take up the banner of his father's work and bring us that liberation Edward sought. Perhaps it's only an exiguous hope, but I believe, after all this, that it is a hope to which I am entitled.
How do you feel about the murder?
Grief. Nothing but unending black grief. The other students have all been tremendously kind and supportive. We've cried together, and we've laughed about the good times Edward gave us. You see, darling, he would have scolded us terribly if we hadn't laughed. It's the way he was. So alive. A celebration of life.
And what about Nicholas Bezick?
Rosette came right out of the flat screen to stand in the cell beside him. A tall, glorious Venus. A goddess wronged and brutally vengeful.
I hope he is raped by every demon in hell.
Nicholas turned over, shuddering, and buried his head under the blanket. He must have fallen asleep, because Lisa Collier was shaking him, her face anxious.
Are you all right?
He blinked against the pink-white light of the Bioloom panel directly overhead.
Yes, fine, thank you. Good. I brought you some clothes.
She dropped his maroon shoulder bag on the floor by his cot. Vernon Langley is going to start the interviews this afternoon. At least you can turn up looking respectable on the AV recording.
Oh.
Nicholas's mood damped down. She shifted her skirt about and sat at the foot of the cot.
Now then, Nicholas, the idea of a police interview is to keep recapping the same ground until you start becoming inconsistent. That can only happen if you don't tell the truth in the first place.
Which brings us to the murder and what happened that night.
I didn't do it.
Nicholas, please, just hear me out.
If you choose to tell the police you are guilty, we can enter a plea of temporarily diminished responsibility. Kitchener was a tetchy old man, inflicting verbal abuse for several months. You just found out your girlfriend was sleeping with him. You certainly had enough cause to lash out. A judge would probably be sympathetic with that, although I have to say the actual nature of the crime would probably eradicate any possibility of a light sentence. Nicholas took a deep breath. Mrs. Collier, why will nobody listen to me? I didn't do it.
Her watery eyes were placid, the sort of gaze his mother used to rebuke him with when he was small. Nicholas, there is a vast amount of evidence amassed against you. There is both motive and opportunity. And, Nicholas, your fingerprints were all over the knife. On top of that, we have the evidence from the Mandels. I might be able to nullify their testimony, or at least blunt it slightly. The courts are still pretty hazy on interpreting psychic visions, but at the moment, it adds up to a very convincing case in the prosecution's favour. I have to tell you, the way it stands, the jury is going to find you guilty. He sat perfectly still, turning the novel concept over in his mind. They, Mrs. Collier, the police, the reporters, Rosette, all truly, genuinely believed him guilty. Against all logic and reason, he was going to have to accept that.
Rational discrimination, Kitchener had said once. That's the dividing line between savagery and civilization. We've thought ourselves up to where we are today, out of the caves and into the skyscrapers. Bodies have never mattered a toss. You are your mind.
So, if you're smart, Nicholas told himself, think your way out of this. Prove your innocence. Images of that night cluttered his vision again. He'd seen the girls. He'd cried on the bed. He'd heard the screaming. And that was it. The total. There was nothing new. No key out of the logic box.
If he could just show he had been in his room sleeping, force them to accept that. But how? Will you still be my lawyer if I plead not guilty?
He asked cautiously. The cyberfax she held in her lap bobbed up and down as her hands twitched unconsciously.
Yes, Nicholas, she said slowly. I'll still be your lawyer. Thank you. I want to plead not guilty. Nicholas, I will still be your lawyer if you admit you did it. A lot of people say they are innocent because they are too ashamed even to acknowledge their crime to their lawyer. It works against them in the long run. I understand. I didn't kill Edward Kitchener. Right.
She unfolded the cyberfax and touched the power stud.
Nothing like an uphill struggle.
It was the first frivolous thing he'd ever heard her say. He almost asked if she believed him, but fright that she might say no held him back.
I suppose I need an alibi, he said.
Her right eyebrow arched.
Yes.
Have you got one you didn't want to mention before? We know Yuri and Liz were together in his room all night. Were you with one of the other girls, secretly?
Isabel or Rosette? You said Rosette did make a pass once.
No.
Now, don't get me wrong. I have to ask. Cecil Cameron?
The Nicholas of yesterday wouldn't have understood the question. Today he thought it was simply a logical thing to ask.
No. How about a channel program? Were you watching one?
No.
The other students, is there a likely candidate who would frame you?
No. Look, I know it's not much, but Greg Mandel said I didn't do it.
At least that's what he thought after he interviewed me. Doesn't that count for something?
Hmm.
She paused, her expression distant. I can probably use any vacillation of opinion on his part to call his psychic ability into question. But that really isn't anything like good enough to get you off.
It's the knife, you see. Have you any idea how your fingerprints did get on that knife?
No.
And now he thought about it, really thought. The fingerprints were impossible to explain away. The murderer creeping into his room and wrapping his hand round the handle as he slept? Unlikely. He didn't sleep that deep. Drugged? But the police had taken a blood sample. The first stirring of panic began to creep over his body, like immersion in a cold lake. Suppose he couldn't prove it. Suppose a jury did find him guilty. There was a state he could sometimes reach, one where the external world became a fable, irrelevant, leaving his mind free to concentrate on problems, like yoga, he always imagined, except yoga was for contemplating spiritually. He dealt with hard facts. That was all he knew.
I didn't do it, he said.
Therefore, somebody else did. That somebody also framed me. And they framed me in a spectacularly clever fashion. They even have me doubting. So, in order to prove my innocence, we have to find them.
He knew Lisa Collier thought he was crazy. Mood changes, from retarded child to punctilious cyborg. Who wouldn't think it of him? It didn't matter, because she could never get him out, not by herself. But she was a lawyer. She had to abide by the rules.
Yes, Nicholas, she said. But how are you going to find him?
I'm not. I'm not good enough. I admit that. We need a professional detective.
Who?
The best.
It was so simple. Sneaky, perhaps, even underhand, but practical. And the last thing he could afford right now was scruples. At the back of his mind, the manes of Edward Kitchener nodded approvingly. He relished the endorsement. Nicholas Beswick finally twigging human emotions. What made people tick? How about that?
And I know how to get him.
He gave Lisa Collier a rapturous grin and pointed at her cyberfax.
Am I allowed a phone call?
What does that mean, the mains?